Good evening. This is a meeting of the Strategic Planning Committee of the Pacifica National Board. The time is 8:38 p.m. Eastern Time. It is April 12th, 2021. My name is Alex Steinberg. I'm the chair of this committee. We do not have a regular secretary, so I will call the roll. Lydia Brazan. Okay, she's not here. Lyndon Foley.
Here.
Okay. James Sagerton. Sagerton. Okay, he's not here.
Hello, I'm here. Did you say Sagerton?
Yes, I did.
Sorry, here.
Okay. Okay, Beth Van Gunten.
Here.
Chris Corey.
Here. Here.
Okay. Julie Hewitt.
Here.
Okay. Sandra Rawline, she told me she won't be able to make it.
Actually, Alex, I'm here.
Oh, you are. Okay.
I'm here.
Okay, you're... Okay. Polina Vasilyev.
I'm here.
Polina is here. Okay. Anita Sims?
Here.
Heather Gray? They're great. Okay, and Alex Steinberg, that's me, I'm here. So we have 9 out of 11. I'm sorry, but I didn't have a chance to send out a draft agenda because I meant to do that, but I got called in for my second vaccine just before this meeting started. So I did not have a chance. I have it in my head. I can just read it orally. But before we do that, can somebody volunteer to be secretary for the evening? So far, I have volunteered, and Julie has volunteered, and not sure who else. Maybe that's it so far.
Lyndon.
Lyndon volunteered. I'll take care of it. I'll give it a shot.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Chris, you're volunteering?
Okay.
Okay, great. Okay. So can you, like, just write down real fast the draft agenda, since I didn't
yes,
do
sir.
It.
Yes, go ahead.
It's pretty simple. The first item is the minutes. We have to approve the minutes from the last session. Julie submitted some minutes. I didn't have a chance to look at them. Did anybody have a chance to review those minutes? Yeah, maybe we could leave approval of the minutes to the next meeting, because I really did not have a chance to even look at them. And Julie indicated that she thought there were some corrections needed. Is that correct, Julie?
Yes, I'm not confident that I did a spectacular job.
Well, okay. I don't know. All right, we can wait till next meeting.
This is James. I just want to say I saw them, but I didn't have a chance to look at them closely.
Okay. The only other item besides approving the minutes that I wanted to do was to review the progress we made in those 5 areas we were all going to study and come back with some research notes or something. And I think... I don't know how much time we need for that. Do you think we can get through all that in like 45 minutes or so?
Yes.
That's reasonable.
All right.
Mr. Singer,
I think
we can get through it in like 5 minutes. If we take the report that was reported during the last PMB meeting, that everybody is looking into multiple things like an advisory board, bitcoins, and whatnot.
Yeah, well, we want to hear, you know, the details of what's been, you know. There was kind of like a homework assignment from the last meeting. Just figure out
yeah.
how to do all this stuff. So
right. Well, I apologize. I missed your first few meetings because I didn't know I was supposed to be on this committee, but. I thought that the report that the Strategic Planning Committee made was very well thought out and good. I thought it was good. And so I just want to express my gratitude for all of those that are working on researching and whatnot. Thank you.
Yeah, well, let's hear what we have. I don't know. I mean, I did a little bit of research. I could have done more. So I think that would be the agenda, basically, the review of the different research areas. Does somebody want to make a motion to accept that as the agenda? I don't know. Okay. We don't need a second. Are there any objections to that, or does somebody want to add anything or have any other ideas in mind for tonight's agenda? Okay, so let's do that then. Who would like? Okay, the five areas again. I'll just list them. The one I brought forward was the creation of an advisory board. I now realize that's an unfortunate name, but the concept is still there. The second idea was floating a bond to pay off our debts. Third idea was monetizing podcasting. Fourth idea was, I don't know how to call it, monetizing our content through digitization. And the final one that we're talking about right now is the building up our emergency preparedness facility so that we can take advantage of certain grants that are available for those kind of things. So who would like to go first with their report?
I'd like to go first, Alex, just so I can dispense with it and focus on the minutes.
Okay. Could you speak up a bit? It's hard to hear you.
Sure. I'll move the phone closer to my face. Is this better?
A little bit. Still kind of
okay.
Hard.
Hold on. Let me turn all the way up. How about now? Any better?
It's better, yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to give kind of a general overview of what a private placement offering is, because there's a lot of uncertainty or confusion about what it is. And I'm just going to read to you from the Investopedia page, because I thought the overview there was pretty good. Here we go. A private placement is...
I'm still having trouble hearing you. Are other people having the same trouble I am?
Yes, you're breaking up.
Yes.
Okay, I can take myself off speakerphone. Is this better?
Yes.
Much better.
Okay.
Hey.
Okay. So after this, I'm going to have to go back on speakerphone so I can write. But I know what I'm going to say, so I don't need to write for what I'm going to say. So here we go. So the once again, this is from Investopedia. A private placement is a sale of stock shares or bonds to a preselected in investors and institutions. In our case, we wouldn't be selling to institutions, rather than to the open market. It's an alternative to initial public offerings for a company seeking to raise capital for expansion, or in our case, refi. Investors are invited to participate in the private placement programs, including wealthy individual investors, banks, and other financial institutions. We wouldn't do that. There wouldn't be any commercial enterprises. We would just basically go to membership. One advantage of a private placement is a relatively few regulatory requirements, which is, I think, key to doing this in this particular way. So there are minimum regulatory requirements and standards for a private placement, even though, like an IPO, it involves the sale of securities. The sale does not even have to be registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The company is not required to provide a prospectus to potential investors, and detailed financial information may not be disclosed. That's actually not the case here, and I'll explain why a little bit later, but because of the, it has to do with the scale of the private offering. The sale of stock on public exchanges is regulated by the SEC, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we don't need that. The same regulation allows an issuer to sell securities to a pre-selected group of investors that meet specific requirements. Instead of a prospectus, private placements can be sold using a private placement memorandum, a PPM, that cannot be broadly marketed to the general public. So one of the difficulties that we have is that we wouldn't be able to announce this on the airwaves. We'd have to figure out a way to do it, like through a direct mailing or something like that. It's an odd situation for us since we're a media company, because that would be our natural way of communicating with our membership. So figuring out how to bypass that particular problem associated with a private placement memorandum is going to be one of the major issues here.
Well, we could certainly do a mailing if we want.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we would have to do, I think, because any other way around it, and we'd have to have a really good membership list to do that, which I hope that we have, especially after this year. I would think that those membership lists will be pretty tight. And this provision is actually not part of the offering. It says that you can only have accredited investors. That's actually not true. There's a rule that allows us to sell to unaccredited investors, but we have to have a description of the offering. So I'll get to that in just a moment. Private placements have become a common way for startups to raise financing, particularly those in the internet and financial technology sectors. It allows the companies to grow and develop while avoiding the full glare of public scrutiny. And then they give an example of it. Above all, a young company can maintain a private entity, avoiding the many regulations and annual disclosure requirements that follow an IPO. The light regulation of private placement allows the company to avoid the time and expense of registering with the SEC. This means that the process of underwriting is faster and the company gets funding sooner. And we do need an underwriter for this, which is a cost associated with it. And I have an estimate for that. If the issuer is selling a bond, it also avoids the time and expense of obtaining a credit rating from a bond agency. I wasn't aware of that until I read this article, so that's kind of cool. A private placement allows the issuer to sell a more complex security to accredited investors who understand the potential risks and rewards. And this was the point that Jim brought up from L.A., but the buyer of private placement bond issues expects a higher rate of interest than can be earned on publicly traded securities. Because of the additional risk of not obtaining a credit rating, a private placement buyer may not buy the bond unless it is secured against specific collateral. So that's going to become a key issue, although, let's face it, our debt is already secured against collateral. So it's not that's not an overwhelming hurdle to overcome. A private placement stock investor, blah, blah, blah. We don't need that. So the exception for us would be, do I have to click on this link here? Hold on just a second. It's not taking me there now, but I remember it. So if we had a fairly small private placement offering, which we're not going to do, then we could offer it to up to 35 non-accredited investors. The other alternative to that is that we have to provide disclosure documents. So that's going to be another expense associated with doing this. And the disclosure documents would reveal financial information about the institution that are probably fairly widely known to the membership. So I don't think it would be an obstacle necessarily to the to them buying that investment. I should also point out to everybody that the current junk bond rates, which are the rates that would govern this type of an offering, are right around 4%. So you can just kind of make a mental note of that. I suspect that those rates will rise as the year goes on. We're in kind of an inflationary interest environment right now. And so it may end up being higher than that, but it's certainly going to be less than the mortgage type note that we're looking at for this to replace. So I may be able to answer questions, but I might not be able to answer questions too. If I can't answer them, I'll just jot them down and get answers for you.
James, the question.
Go ahead, James. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I'm not sharing. I'm not sharing. Go ahead, Alex. My apologies.
That's all right. I have a question too, but Jim jumped the stack, so go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to know if there are mechanisms built in, or if we would have to create mechanisms to prevent too much ownership in too few hands in this kind of a situation. I mean, is there a danger that some with deep pockets could scoop up, you know, I know it's not a stock offering and we're not talking about control by holding a majority of the stock, but is there any danger along those lines?
Good question.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine that we can constrain the amount of bonds offered to any individual investor, but I will look into that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, this is Sandra. May I speak?
I have a question first. You can go right after me.
Beth, I'm just back to.
Okay. Sandra and then Beth, okay. Chris, you say that this would have to be collateralized, but we have already collateralized all our real estate, and that's basically what we have available to collateralize. We own other things that are of value, but we're not going to collateralize our broadcast signals for.
Of course not. Yes.
So
yeah. I was thinking that we could just collateralize the real estate, but I understand the problem. It's already encumbered. So the question is, could we encumber it with the idea that if the bond offering was fulfilled, that collateral could be used as collateral for the bond offering? And I don't know the answer to that question either. Good question. Great question, actually. Hadn't considered that problem.
Well, it could be a possibility once we get out of the collateralization of our real estate, which means the payback of the loan, essentially. But it sounds like it might be difficult to use this as a method of paying back the loan if we don't have any other thing to collateralize.
Exactly.
You could do a simultaneous
so
switch. It might help.
Exactly. So basically how we could do it would be as soon as the bond offering was fulfilled, that the property would become the collateral. But that's a great question. I would need to ask an underwriter that question.
Okay. Let's go on. Sandra, then Beth.
Paulina would like to be on the stack as well.
Hi. Okay, so wouldn't our current audits suffice to document what we're doing in this regard?
Yes, but there's – I'm sorry, may I answer that, Alex?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yes, but – the prospectus would have to have other information about it as well. For example, anybody who buys a bond offering like this is going to want to know about transferring it. And private placements are notoriously sticky for transferring, which is a disincentive for purchasing them. So obviously we don't want the bonds to end up in the hands of the general public. We want the bond to be retained by members. That's the only intelligent way to do it. So it would have to be restricted to other members, but how to actually do the transfer to another member would be something that would have to be in that prospectus and have to be worked out in advance. And yeah, the mechanism for that would probably be something that an underwriter would know, because after all, small bond offerings are not uncommon. Churches, schools, other institutions of this kind often have members-only bond offerings like this to finance various projects that they're doing. And then the transfer of these bonds has to be taken into account. I would, however, note that members are probably not going to be terribly concerned about how to transfer the bond. They're probably going to buy the bond for the purpose of helping Pacifica, just as they would make a donation to help Pacifica. And so they're not going to worry about selling the bond. In fact, they may re-up the bond when the bond offering comes due, and just continue, you know, with the bond offering, unless we can purchase it back at the end, which is, of course, the optimistic hope on the part of Pacifica, that we would just buy the bond back when the seller wanted to sell it, that we would become the buyer as an institution.
They could also become donations.
Absolutely.
Okay, I think Beth is next.
Thank you. A thought regarding one of the previous questions. It probably would take some effort to establish any actual dollar value of the PNR, as collateral, but we have a significant archive, and that relates to one of the other strategic planning proposals. Maybe we can address that later. And a question I'm wondering, I don't have experience buying or selling bonds, so would it be expected that we would make an offer and we would sell everything we had a capacity to sell at one time, or would this be like an ongoing offering? Would there be we establish it and then there's kind of an ongoing effort to promote these up to, you know, to the point where we have sold whatever bonds we have relative to our collateral, and then manage the turnover to whatever extent there was turnover?
Yeah, I think what we would want to do is try and get the bond out there as quickly as possible, because if this thing trickled in over too long a period of time, like say we could make the bond offering over 1 year, have a time limit on it, and if we weren't able to meet that year, we'd probably keep everything in an escrow account, and if we weren't able to meet the bond offering in a year, we'd give an offer to redeem the offering or something. I'm not exactly sure how to do it if it falls short. I would, however, say that, you know, we do have 50,000 members, and it seems to me, and a lot of them are nearing retirement age, it seems to me like an offering from Pacifica would be attractive to quite a few of those members. I might be mistaken about that. I mean, I haven't surveyed for it or asked anybody. It just seems like, to a casual observer, that it might actually be a pretty easy offering to fulfill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Sandra again.
Yeah, Polina was on the stack first, and if you want
okay.
to go.
And then Julie.
Julie?
Oh, thank
okay.
you.
Yeah, so,
thank you.
So Polina, then Julie, then Sandra. Go ahead.
Great. I'm wondering the option that Chris is asking us to look into right now, or proposing that we investigate together, how is that necessarily more beneficial than, for instance, EIDL loans, right? Because we received the small EIDL loans. I believe more loans were announced. Prior approved borrowers are actually eligible for those. I would imagine the IED may be looking into that, but I don't know, perhaps I'm just thinking, my understanding is that there's a lot of, at least for short term, there are a lot of resources available to nonprofits that are perhaps government secured, and also where you don't have to sign your soul away or your editorial line away to an underwriter. Just a question, but I'm going to hold off. If we get a chance at this meeting to talk about EIDL loans, I would love to revisit that. Thank you.
Alex, may I answer?
Sure.
Okay. So the EIDL loan is available for up to $2 million, as I understand it. There's no guarantee, of course, that we'll get that $2 million. But, I mean, that is the proposed limit that I've heard about. And if that were to take place, that would wipe out the majority of the debt that we're talking about here. I'm assuming that for purposes of investigation that we're not going to get the EIDL loan. But if we did get the EIDL loan, then retiring the remaining balance of the debt would probably be easier done through other instruments than this. Because if we do a PPM on this, we are going to probably spend upwards of six figures on this to develop the prospectus. I mean, just consider the cost of distribution of a prospectus, okay? If we could make a prospectus for less than a buck, I would be really, really surprised. And there's 50,000 that we would have to distribute or something on that order. That's a lot of paper. That's a lot of trees. I guess we could email it. That's possible. I don't know if that actually works for the rules governing these things. That's something else I should look into because the cost is prohibitive. But then, of course, we have to prepare that prospectus as well and ask to have all the legalese. And so we're talking about attorneys and underwriters. You know, it's not an inexpensive thing to do. So if we can't go for the whole ball of wax on this, I think it's probably unwise to do it at all. It's kind of an all or none thing.
Okay. All right. I think Julie was next.
Yeah. The question I was going to ask was the underwriting cost, which you had earlier alluded to but then had described. Is the underwriting cost primarily what you would pay the underwriting company plus whatever it would take to send prospectuses out to, you know, people who were interested?
Yeah, so for an offering of our size, it would be there would be a flat fee for the underwriting, and I think that they usually charge that on a percentage basis of the offering. It's actually not that high, but it's significant in terms of the cost because I think it's the number that I remember, and I should check into this to be absolutely sure, but the number I remember was a point and a half. So that would be about 50,000 just right there, okay, for the underwriter to prepare the documentation for the offering and to assist with the legal framework to present it. And I guess, does their obligation end once the offering is done, or is there some sort of follow-up? I don't know the answer to that either, actually. I really should get on the phone with an underwriter at this point and try and figure out what exactly their obligations and costs are, because I don't know. I've never done anything like this before, so I would need to investigate that. That would be the next level, I think.
Got it. Thanks.
Okay. I think Sandra wanted to ask another question.
Well, I'm still back to the same question. And I apologize if I'm being redundant, but I was trying to determine if the current audits that are ongoing at this time can be used to validate this request.
And I think the answer to that is yes, but I'm sorry that I was so short with that and jumped right over it, but that wouldn't be all that was necessary. In other words, we couldn't just present them with the audit. That would provide the financial backbone for the offering, but it wouldn't provide the additional details on what the offering consisted of, what its term was, what the interest rate being paid was. How the bonds were exchanged. All of that stuff would have to be covered in addition to that. But yes, the financial part would be covered by the audit, I believe.
Okay, so may I ask a follow-up question?
You go ahead.
So what do we need to do if we proceed with this endeavor to secure it? I mean, our audits are ongoing, and we can present that, and we can, you know, make up a write-up or something saying that this is what we want to do, this is what we hope to achieve. But are we on sound footing trying to do that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful advantage to a private placement offering is that since we're going to a selected class and not to the general public, there's the amount of paperwork that's necessary to get this done is fairly minimal, but we would need to enlist the help of an underwriter to do it. So that would be the next step, the next course of action on this. And, of course, that would have to be run by the PMB because there's a significant cost associated with it.
Okay, so let me
Lyndon to the stack.
Okay, Lyndon, you can go first.
Thank you, Chair. Chris, I'm very encouraged by the research that you've done so far. That sounds really good and pretty much along the lines as I thought. And to everybody who's worried about, and even you, Chris, you keep saying six figures. I mean, I think I'm not worried about the cost of doing this because it doesn't sound like it's, you know, extraordinary. It sounds like it's in line. And we could be borrowing or we could be placing bonds for $4 million or $5 million or something.
That's
could be more
correct.
Than just, it could be, you know, so we could have money to, you know, some of these dreams that we thought we, you know, that are going to save Pacifica. This is an opportunity right there. Anyway, so it sounds very promising to me. Did you talk to that lady that I sent you the email to?
I haven't. I knew this question was going to come, Lyndon, and I apologize
for
that,
well,
but I have not gotten around to that. I will do it. It's going to happen. But Lyndon's right. We could actually cover the cost of the offering through the offering, for example.
We definitely will.
So this doesn't have to come out of pocket at all. But nonetheless, I would need to have, because of the significance of the amount, it would need to be run by the PMB, of course.
Okay. And Alex, may I have one follow up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you plan on talking to a an underwriter?
Yes. I mean, that would be, I just wanted to get everybody up to speed as to where we were at this juncture. And yes, that's the very next step. So I would actually do that this week as long as nobody objects to that idea.
All right. So, well, that's basically what I wanted to ask you, Chris. What is the next step here? Are we almost ready to make a decision on this and decide whether we're going to go forward, or do we still need more information, or do we need to get input, for instance, from NEDA, from the Finance Committee? Where are we with this?
Okay, let me just say that I consider this an exploratory exercise at this juncture. And so I just want to make sure that my assumptions are correct to start with. And the safest way for me to do that is just to contact an underwriter and just basically read them everything that I read you and list all the assumptions that I felt that I have and just explain our situation and make sure that it comports with a private placement offering, PPM, a private placement memorandum. And if all of that is correct, then yes, I should probably circle back to one of the committees, either this one or finance, I think, would be the best two. Probably this one, since it originated here, and report back whatever my findings were. In other words, kind of get something more concrete than I have right now. What I have now is a kind of a general outline with a bunch of assumptions. And I do have some questions, you know? the collateral question is excellent, and I don't know how to resolve that. So that's a really good one.
So
that's stuck.
We'll wait till we get more info then.
Yes.
Anita.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Thank you. This is question that I'm sure you don't have the answer to, but I want to put it out there for our consideration as to how this will play out long term. The people we're looking to invest in this financial instrument would likely be the same pool that we think of as our major donors, our sustaining donors, sustaining members. Excuse me. And I'm just considering what this might do to that dynamic. If people tie up investments, their investment with us in the terms of this bond or memorandum, then are they going to do that instead of continuing to donate on an ongoing basis? Will this loan to us, in effect, displace out-and-out gifts? And I know there's no way to answer that now, but...
No, there isn't, but there are kind of two parts to that question, I think.
Yeah.
What the long-term prospects for this are, which
right.
I think I can address. The other is whether it would actually displace fundraising, which is actually a concern that has come up over and over again. And I don't know the answer to the second question. I do not know the answer to that. My assumption, which may be completely wrong, is that this will attract a different type of, quote, donation, unquote. It's not a donation anymore. It's an investment. And it's kind of interesting because it makes members to some degree owners of Pacifica, which is different than how they sit right now. How they sit right now is they're basically, you know, this is basically like a subscription service, right? They're donating money to us and we're providing them with content. I mean, that's how it works now. But if they become bondholders, then they're providing us with a loan and we're providing them collateral for that loan. And so it's a slightly different relationship, but we are, of course, targeting the same people. So I don't know the answer to the second question, but the first is that at maturity, these people would have to figure out what to do. But in the meantime, you know, after the original placement was fulfilled, there wouldn't be any additional offerings available unless there was a transfer agreement in place between individual members where they could transfer the bonds from one to another.
Right.
And in those cases, the person liquidating would receive the funds that their original investment plus some interest probably. And that would be available for donation. So presumably they'd be back on the donor block and the person who bought the bond would presumably not be in that position. But I would think that after the initial offering, it wouldn't have any impact on fundraising whatsoever. But initially it might. It might. That is entirely possible. Pacifica raises approximately $10 million a year. We're talking about throwing another $3 million on top of that. And for a one-year period. Now, whether that $3 million would be in addition to our normal fundraising or whether it would displace it, I really can't say. I would, however, say this, and that's that it would not the necessity for repaying that principal would suddenly be. I'll use the word ameliorated for the moment rather than completely eliminated, because it isn't. We would have another type of obligation, but it wouldn't be as restrictive of an obligation as the one we have right now.
Paulina, to the stack after Linda, if I may.
We have to wrap up this segment of the meeting because we'll never get to anything else if we don't.
Sorry about that, Alex. I opened a can of worms.
It's wonderful that you got all this information and just all right. Let's just finish the current stack and then we'll go on to another topic.
Alex, I have a quick question. Could you add me to the stack?
All right. I heard Pauline. I heard James. Anybody else?
I think Linda.
I heard Linda before me, but I'm actually going to skip this. My turn.
It's Anita, and then it's Lyndon, and then it's Paulina, and then it's James.
Yeah, I heard that order.
If you don't mind, Paulina, I'll stay out.
Okay. Okay. Anita, did you want to say something?
Yes, I actually was just going to comment on what Chris was talking about. That's exactly what I remember, having worked with a small not-for-profit doing the small bond offering. So I'm going to also hopefully be able to do some legwork for you, Chris, or at least be able to look into it, because I was actually doing that. But my other comment was, someone mentioned the EIDL loan. The National Office did recently receive an email saying that the SBA recently had announced a policy change that increased the loan limit up to 24 months with a maximum loan of $500,000. So it's not $2 million as it had originally started. Just wanted to comment on that.
And it's only 24 months?
Yes.
Because the original EIDL loan, I recall, was like several years or something.
Yes. I'd be happy to send this email out. Actually, it came from Lydia.
That's not particularly good news then about the EIDL loan.
Yes, that's why I wanted to say that it may be that we want to go this route as opposed to expecting $2 million from a loan that at one time was longer. I want to say it was probably 5 years.
Okay. Well, thanks for letting us know.
You're welcome.
Okay, James?
No, Lyndon.
Yeah, I think Lyndon.
Go ahead, Lyndon.
This will be short. I just wanted to say the worry about displacing donations because of the bond offering, I don't think that's going to happen. For one thing, we are going to owe a coupon to people, I believe, and people could actually use that coupon to make a donation.
Yeah. Okay. James?
I have two things. And one requires, well, they both require a response. So I'll just do them both. I'm just wondering if doing this would create a new kind of addiction. We've seen this phenomenon at least a couple of our stations where we gradually moved into a premium-based fundraising model, and now we find it very difficult to back out of that. Does anyone see any danger of this resulting in the same phenomena of becoming dependent on it? I realize it's intended to be short term, but it's so attractive and it might be easy at first, and might it become a more long range thing? And then the second thing was, Chris, I think you mentioned an article that you had looked at, and I checked my email. I didn't see it. Do you have a citation for the article that you cited?
Oh, the Investopedia thing? I'll send that to everybody.
Thank you.
Okay.
Was there any answer to my question about is there any danger of this becoming habitual or, you know, in a good way or a bad way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is entirely possible. In fact, the issue of retiring the obligation exists no matter what we do. So I think really what this boils down to is who we prefer to owe our obligation to. And the whole thing, my primary motivation in this whole thing is that if our obligation was to our membership, that is like very much in accord with our mission. You know, we're already obligated to our membership. And so it just seemed like a natural pairing to me, a more natural pairing than having an outside institution that could possibly deprive us of the liberty to do what we do as an institution. And so I agree with you that the problem of the debt still exists no matter what we do here. There is one other tiny advantage to this, though, and that's that when the bonds come up for renewal, we could either offer them to other members or we could retire them. In other words, it might be a way to retire this debt little pieces at a time instead of being obligated to retire it in one large chunk. I, once again, not having ever done a bond offering before, I'm just speculating on this because I don't know how this would play out over time, but I do agree with you that it doesn't disobligate us from paying the debt. It just changes who we owe it to. Instead of owing it to one corporation, public or otherwise, we would owe it to our membership. And I just think that that would be a preferable situation to the one we find ourselves in.
Let me just say this. Ideally, the way we'd like to be funded is listeners give us money for the content that we provide them, the programs. That was basically Lou Hill's original vision. Now we're somewhere, you know, we're sort of partly there these days, but we also are partly in other places. The high cost premium model has to some extent displaced that other model. And this would be yet another something else that could displace that model. So I think that's still the ideal, but we have to be honest and say we haven't been able to sustain the foundation based on that ideal model for quite some time.
Yeah, it's pushing us further and further out of our natural orbit. I agree with that, actually.
Yeah. Okay, let's go on to another topic. You want to talk about the digitization of original content? Because I did a little bit of research on that myself. Are you asking me? Well, either you or Chris. I don't. Did you? Yeah. Either one of you.
I'm going to step out of the conversation so I can take notes. Thank you.
Okay.
I, after talking to James, who informed the, I think Mark Torres at the archives of the idea, I contacted him via email Friday morning. I haven't heard anything back from him. On the PNB, also Ollie stepped up and said he had some experience with this genre of currency. And so I immediately latched on to him. I had a little communication with him today, just asking him if he had a wallet. And that is the beginnings of, so he does have a wallet. He owns about five or eight different types of cryptocurrencies. So he has a look into that. And one reason that's important is because we will have to pay some fee if we're ever able to find a place to put any of our archives, any of our URLs, or however it works out, up for auction. So that's the beginning, and we can buy fractional shares. I think the Ether is selling at like $2,200 per. Bitcoin is around $50,000 or $58,000 per. So we sure don't want to be getting any of that. But so that and I've I keep coming across more articles in my reading, and there may be 300 different auction houses. Ali asked me what I was looking at, and I just looked at a couple at the time, last week when I spoke with him, and I emailed those to him, and he said, oh, those are interesting, but you think those people are going to be interested in what we have? And I said, no, we're going to have to find our market. we're going to have to find our customers. And then we don't necessarily have to set this up for a long-running situation. Now, if we could, that would be fine. But really, my vision in the short term is just to see if we can get lucky a couple of times. And I still need some expertise. So
Lyndon, I had a talk today with the webmaster from WBAI who has also been researching this area recently. And what I would like to do is arrange a conference with you and Chris and Ali, I guess, if he wants to be involved with this person. Can we try to do that in the next couple of days sometime?
I'm available.
Chris,
well,
what about
tomorrow's yeah. Finance, then LSB is the day after that, then PNB is the day after that, but we might squeeze something in.
Well, we could try it. And are you, either of you available in afternoons?
Yeah, I'm available pretty much every afternoon. I have little conflicts here and there, so we'd have to work around them, but yes.
Okay, let's see if we can.
I'm available.
I think it would be useful if we all just sat down and see if we could figure out something.
Hey, Chair, we're at time for this item. Can I move to extend for 15?
Sure. Any objections? All right. Are there any questions, or should we just go on to the next item? We don't have.
Here.
All right, Felina.
Yeah. Very briefly. So I believe in the past we've been able to fundraise around the archives quite a bit. And I understand that now we're talking about monetizing the archives in a different way, but still, when the fact remains that these archives, we have thousands and thousands of undigitized tapes that still is waiting for that one listener that wants to hear that rare recording, right? That rare voice, and I think this could be better. Maybe better crowdsource or crowdsource in conjunction with whatever is being proposed. So I'm just trying to think that this also has to be so that we don't veer away from the mission, and maybe we don't need to think about two or three, you know, big hits, so to say. We can think about how we can actually talk about being relevant, because we are and we should be. It's just that, you know, I'm talking to my neighbor. She asked me, what do you do? And I say, oh, you know, I do some volunteer work for Pacifica. She said, oh, Pacifica, yeah, I used to listen to that. My neighbor is, I think, in her late 70s. I used to listen to that. Haven't seen, is that still around? You know, and the archives. I mean, I understand that the financial mechanisms can be, that we have several options that we're exploring. I don't know if cryptocurrency necessarily has to be part of it. I mean, even if any kind of crowdsourcing model, crowdfunding, PayPal, Patreon, whatever works. I understand that for a foundation would be different than for private individuals, but that's pretty much as I've thought about it. Thank you.
Yeah, Paulina, just this is a completely different kind of way to generate revenue from the archives. It really has nothing to do with what we've done in the past, and those things can still go on. It doesn't preclude that. But this is something completely different. It's
financial only, right? Separate from the public.
No. You're not getting it. It's
okay, please.
Something like what we used to do is we'd offer people a thumb drive or something with, you know, selections from the archives or something like that. What we're talking about is offering them like the digital equivalent of an original, like a lithograph, Salvador Dali, and you produce 100 lithographs of something, and that's it. And everybody who buys that buys one of those is guaranteed that you're only one of 100 that has this. So it's something like that. It's in a digital universe.
Got it. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Okay, I got to run. Talk to you.
Okay. So Alex, this is Heather. I just want to ask a question about that. So are you saying this would be like there would be a certain select portion of the archives that would be offered this way? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, we haven't figured out any of that.
This is Lyndon. I'd like to answer that.
Yeah, go ahead, Lyndon.
Well, first of all, I don't know exactly what's in the archives. I looked the other day and I think it was like 2,600 different items, or maybe it was 26,000, but I looked at several that were really interesting, and probably everything wouldn't be eligible for this. And I'm not even sure that anything is eligible at this point. We're going to have to find and this is a developing market. This stuff is growing every day. So what we have a month from now may be different. I mean, what the market is and what the selling houses are could be different a month from now than they are today. They will be different a month from now than they are today. So I'm just trying to get us positioned to have as much knowledge as we can that we can, if and when the iron is hot, we can strike. And yeah, I would pick out, or we would pick out, or the people at the archives would pick out four or five things that we could use and just run a test on something. Like I would, you know, if we could get anything at auction, I might buy something for $300. You know, and I think all it is we are going, I would then own a URL, which I would be able to put in my Bitcoin digital cryptocurrency wallet. I'd be able to open it up and say, oh, there's a picture of something in the archives at Pacifica. I swear, I think that's all there. I think that's what there is to it. And we would still be able to sell for $17.99, you know, copies of that exact thing.
And we don't lose any copyright on anything either.
All right, Alex, okay. This is Heather. Can I just say one final thing here? I just want to tell everybody that I think it's so incredibly important that the archives are being discussed, because I also think that we should be doing a heck of a lot more media attention to what's available in these archives. I mean, certainly for the general public, but also for universities and so forth, because it represents such an important history in America. I know you all know this, but anyway, I'm looking forward to hearing what is decided on this, but I'm looking forward to additional discussion about it as well. So thanks for bringing it up.
This is Lyndon. Can I get on the stack once again?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Lyndon.
One other thing that occurred to me during all of this is, as Chris said, a lot of our listeners are getting old and, you know, retirement age, but so many of the baby boomers, and that's where the money is. That's where the people who know who who Patty Hearst is. Those are the people who know who George Carlin is. Let's get them before they die. Okay. Let's see if some of them want to loosen their pockets some.
Go
ahead.
Two quick things. One is kind of the same question I asked Chris about the private placement bond. What kind of upfront cost might we face as Pacifica if we tried to take this route, right? Before I let you answer that one, Lyndon, the second observation that I have is kind of based on what Heather just said, which is, and I think also something that Chris said when we were talking about the private placement bond, that we didn't have to, you know, restrict ourselves to thinking that the private placement bond would be just for the 3.1 million that we
OFJC, but we could, you know, we could do something like figure out what would it cost to digitize some of the most important parts of the archives that aren't currently digitized. And then, you know, let's just assume for a moment that costs $900,000, right? That puts us at an even $4 million. And if that's the private placement bond amount that we were going out for, and part of what we were getting people to sort of buy into, the reason that they were with when I helped purchase one of these bonds, is that they would be helping us, you know, do a lot more work in terms of digitizing our archives. I could see, you know, if you're doing something like that, that's how you can issue a private placement bond that keeps people from, you're not competing with people who are donating to the stations. Here they'd see, oh, I'm doing the world some good because I'm helping to digitize the archives. So, but if Lyndon has any insight on the question.
Yeah, let me, I think there's some confusion here. Digitizing the archives is an ongoing project in which we take recordings that are on maybe 8-reel tapes or cassettes or something and put them on a digitized medium of some sort. I don't know what they're using at this point. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about creating, the technical term is non-fungible tokens. And this is all involved with the world of cryptocurrency.
Yes. No, I completely sorry, Alex. I completely understand that. I'm just saying this would be a way. It's separate. It's on top of, right? But it's, you know, it's different than what Lyndon's talking about. I want to be perfectly clear. I understand that distinction. I just was based on Heather's comment, just trying to say, hey, if the pace of the digitizing of the archives is too slow, and by that I mean putting in electronic media, what's analog, that's something that we could add to the private placement bond issue.
Oh, okay. Sure.
This is Lyndon.
Lyndon?
I would say I agree with that, and we're not quite there, of course, but yeah, I'm glad you're thinking ahead. And also, when we were talking about collateral, our archives are collateral. They do have some worth. We spend a lot of time and many years husbanding those things, haven't we? So they must be worth something to us.
Absolutely.
Okay. Anybody else have anything?
Well, did Lyndon have any insight on upfront costs that it would take to sort of set up the, okay, now I'm going back to the cryptocurrency NFT idea.
I'm sorry. It's small. It's very small. I did see, and that's why I was looking about, you know, having a wallet and if you can have fractional shares of a coin, but it's small, you know, a point and a half, two and a half, something like that.
I did a little research myself. It's a very minimal upfront cost for this, especially if we just want to do like an experiment, you know. Anyone else? Okay, what's next? I guess I can say a couple of quick things about the advisory board idea. I didn't have a chance to research it in depth, but what little I did do, this is a common thing that many nonprofit boards do, where they create an advisory board that's kind of like a parallel structure to their board of directors, but it has very different functions. It doesn't make policy, so it doesn't. It's not a rival to the board of directors in any way, but it's supposed to be there to assist the organization in terms of people have certain expertise, or they may be people who could be helpful in reaching major donors or even just provide a level of prestige to the organization. But what I have realized is calling it an advisory board is probably not a great idea because we already have community advisory boards and people are going to confuse that, the community advisory boards, with what we're talking about here, which is not at all the same thing. Community advisory boards, as you know, are members of the community, usually volunteers, who on the local level try to assist their local station by giving them some feedback as to, you know, what they think is appropriate for the kind of programming and so on. This is different. These would be people that we would handpick. The mechanism of selecting who should be an advisory board has, you know, would be determined, but, you know, it could be initially people that are elected by the national board, and maybe once that gets going, the advisor, you know, whatever we're going to call this, could sort of have their own elections or something. I don't know. I don't know. We'd have to figure that one out. But anyway, this could either be an amendment to our bylaws, although it's not, it's really not, wouldn't be a requirement that we have to amend our bylaws to do this, but it may be a good idea just to sort of institutionalize it. So that's about what I've learned about this. Anybody have any questions or anything? Yes? No?
Julie, a thought?
Yeah.
I like the idea because I could see us getting people with well-known names who would help with the prestige of the organization. And I think, though, that it makes way more sense to do something like this once we have maybe a better developed development officer kind of framework within the foundation to really, you know, squeeze the maximum value out of an advisory board.
Okay. Anybody else? I mean, an advisory board could actually maybe help us with a development structure, help us figure out how to do one.
Alex, has there been some other kind of conceptual framework as well, like where the advisory board would be coming from, what kind of folks they would be, I mean, what kind of expertise, or has there been that discussion as well?
No.
Okay, all right. That's all right. All right, okay, that's all right. I just wondered. Okay.
Yeah.
This is Beth the Stack.
Yeah, Beth.
I just want to acknowledge that I'm quite familiar with the concept and that it can take just about any configuration we want to give it and that it can be more or less useful depending on how we manage it and that it's probably a good idea if we do it well. And I don't see a lot of downsides to it other than just that in my limited experience, I'm still pretty new to the actual governance structure. I see that we have a whole lot of structure and function and we produce a lot of decisions that are really, really hard to find reference to later. So we're not great on implementation. So if we're going to do this, we should get clear before we launch what it is we want from people and how we're going to structure that process. But in general, in principle, it's probably a good thing. It's a useful tool among nonprofits and very, very familiar from way back across many nonprofit fields.
there's a lot of resources out there for how to do this. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, the way I'm envisioning it, some people have criticized us because we don't have experts, quote, experts, on our board of directors. And to some extent, that's true because, you know, we're a democratically elected board, and we may have some experts, we may not, but that's not the criteria by which people are placed on the board generally. But this would be a way for us to get some experts. it could be a very good supplement to what the board does.
This is Beth again, briefly.
Yeah.
In my experience, and from what I've read and seen, one of the advantages in having an advisory board is that the people serve in a strictly advisory capacity, alleviating the issue of liability, so that many people who may favor what we do but shy away from actual service on the boards because of issues of liability, which are even greater in this organization than in many other nonprofits, they could serve in that advisory capacity without taking on those issues of liability. So you get people who will be willing to step forward in that capacity who might not be prepared to actually run for office and then show up at all these meetings and sit through everything we do with all the liability that goes with that. Thank you.
Okay, good point. anybody else? Lyndon?
Chris Corey.
Oh, was that Chris? I didn't
sorry, Chris Corey. I haven't been chiming in for a while. We're past time again, so we need to extend, and we're down to two items, which is monetizing podcasting and emergency prep funding. Just
okay,
letting you know.
Well, it's 10 minutes to 10. Why don't we just, can we extend for 10 minutes and then just adjourn and see if we can say something about the last two items in the next 10 minutes?
All moved.
Okay. Anybody object to that? Okay. Well, unless there's other questions, let's go on to the next item, monetizing podcasting. I don't know did anybody do any research on that yet? Okay. I guess that one has not been done yet. So, I'll take some responsibility for doing something on that before our next meeting. I know there have been some discussions about this at WBAI, and I wouldn't be surprised if there have been other discussions I'm not aware of at some of our other stations, but I think...
This is Chris again.
Yeah, Chris.
I was just going to say that I believe Ali mentioned that particular thing as well, so... he could
okay.
probably be enlisted into that if you so choose.
Yeah, I can, and I know some of the people have been discussing it at WBAI, and again, I'm sure it's at least come up in discussions at some of the other stations because it is, you know, it's been a pretty important source of revenue for some of the NPR stations, so there's no reason why we shouldn't be considering it. Okay, so let's move on then. The last item that we were supposed to do some more research on was the emergency preparedness and how we can maybe take advantage of the assistance that's offered for that. Beth, do you have some more information about that?
Just preliminary, I've been having a number of conversations with people I'm not ready to name names because I'm trying not to scare people off, but just trying to assess what our current status is, if anybody actually has current plans or has had in the past, and going through various templates to see which ones make the most sense for us to use to get to some sort of a standardized process. There are a lot available out there via FEMA and private industry as well. I'm just kind of chewing through the homework. Nothing, no actual results yet to report, but I love this stuff. So I'm having a good time. And if anybody else wants to talk about it with me, I hope you all know how to get a hold of me. If anybody is interested in volunteering for the task or volunteering someone else for the task, you know your stations better than I do. I'm open to all suggestions at this point, and I hope to have more to report sometime soon. Thank you. If there are questions, I don't know that I have answers yet, but
Chris Corey to the stack.
Chris?
Yeah, I'm just curious. You seem to feel, and I'm not doubting you on this, by the way, that there's a significant amount of funding available for this particular area. Could you specify how much funding is available, or how you develop that impression? Thank you.
I think it's comparable to the scale of the PPP money we've gotten since this is FEMA money specifically for critical infrastructure, including capital investments and planning, emergency preparedness, but for the physical plants that could help us. I think we limp along with quite a bit of deferred maintenance and manage to do so day to day most of the time, but when those big ones hit, like Sandy in New York or Harvey in Houston, or we're still waiting for our really big one out here, we get lots of fires, and the Bobcat fire was nibbling at the toes of Mount Wilson this last summer, and I was watching that hour by hour and in touch with people at the station. And they're especially in time, they use FEMA and other related funding sources as a conduit for stimulus money when we find ourselves in the kind of predicament that we're in at the moment. It's like when all else fails, if there's money for anything, there's money for FEMA. And if we can define our needs in terms that they relate to, then we're in. It makes a big difference if we have there's a certain baseline of emergency preparedness that's required by law, and if we acknowledge that a little more formally and comply with existing requirements, it helps to begin to align us for that kind of funding down the road. So at this point, I'm looking for both OSHA and at least I know California law better than I do law for other states, but I'm assuming there's something comparable.
Yes.
What?
Yes. One observation I have about that, I think there might be like extra funding if you cover like the rural areas because they are most vulnerable to communications blackouts, and you might have a situation where you don't have internet or phone service, but you might still have radio service.
Exactly. And
I know this,
I know our California sections cover huge areas, including many rural areas, so that could be
interesting. Very much the case. It's also true that in terms of FEMA risk ratings, Los Angeles comes in at the absolute very top of their riskiest places in the country because of the population level and the variety of risks that we're subject to. And that also feeds into our eligibility. And following up on what Alex said, that sooner or later, the Internet does go. The Internet is not nearly as durable as broadcast radio. Not that broadcast radio can't be knocked out, but it's much less likely to be knocked out than digital access, phones and the Internet. And so when that happens, that's when people go rummaging around in the trunk of their car or the back of the closet or the depth of a drawer to find a broadcast radio that they may not have used for a while, and then they just search the dial. And if they find you, if they find us in that moment, and we provide them with actually useful information, something that they feel the need to evacuate, and they don't know which to go because there's smoke everywhere. You go up, you go down the coast. And if we can provide that kind of information in the moment, they will never forget us. You know, they found us, now they know us, and they won't let us go. And I've watched it really work to leverage up the standing of various different public radio stations in this region. I've been through a number of the big fires out here in the last few years, and floods and that kind of thing, and been involved with Community Emergency Response Team, which is retraining provided by FEMA. I didn't know it when I signed on, but that turned out to be what it was. And then that led to me getting my ham radio license and working at the county level with emergency preparedness with the fire department and the auxiliary communications service. And I've been doing that now 12, 13, 14 years, something like that. And there's so much potential. That, and if you're prepared, you're much more likely to, first, not to lose, or to maintain that continuity of service, continuity of operation. That's one of the objectives in the kind of funding that they provide, some of the kind of funding that they provide, so that you never actually go down, or you never actually lose the capacity to receive donations or payments. Or if you do, you're prepared to get back up and running sooner than you would be if you hadn't been prepared. So that's just preliminarily off the top of my head, some of the thinking that goes into seeing this as a valuable pursuit. We're talking billions of dollars that's going to be made available for this, and especially because the places we have our signals are generally some of the higher risk places that will put us higher on their list of priorities.
Well, I know the KPFK signal is I think that's the strongest signal in the country, isn't it?
It's the strongest signal west of the Mississippi.
West of the Mississippi? You mean there's something east of the Mississippi that's stronger?
That's the implication. It used to be that signals were allowed to be stronger, like as strong as we are in the earlier days of radio, and then it was capped at 50,000 watts, which is the standard, you know, the strongest signals around these days. There are none of them more than about 50,000 watts. We're 112,000, which makes us just gargantuan. I will send a map of our signal area. We reach, when we're functioning as we should, we can reach all the way from the Mexican border up to close to Point Conception, which is as far on the other side of Los Angeles as the border is there, and up into the back country. And
you can reach Santa Barbara, right?
And a little bit beyond. With repeaters, we can do that. And I suspect it's one of the things that motivated me to run, that I can, because I have a radio sense, it was the war with Iraq that first motivated me to, I hadn't been able to get the signal up in the mountain valley where I live for quite a while, but when that war hit and I couldn't find any authentic news, I got out my T-wire and I danced around the living room until it wasn't a great signal. It wasn't like a music quality signal, but I could understand the words. And for me, that was sufficient. And I thumbtacked that T-wire to the ceiling right where I could, just that one sweet spot where I could get that signal. And I listened to it there for years and years. But I think we can do better than that. And so I would hope we could get some funding just to assess our current system and strengths and weaknesses and the potential for improved signal coverage and that kind of thing. And that's the sort of thing I think one of the many things that emergency preparedness funding could do for us.
Okay. That's very good. Thank you, Beth.
Possibly more than you wanted to know.
I think we need to adjourn, but before we do that, let's decide on the next meeting. Shall we do it in 2 weeks?
Sounds good.
Is that all right?
I agree. It sounds good.
Okay. Then I'll post the meeting for 2 weeks from tonight, unless, hopefully the spot's not taken. I'll figure out something. Okay, can we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved. Chris Corey.
I'll second.
Anybody object? No? Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks all. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye.